Greetings and welcome. I'm Mark Pitstick, your host for Ask the Soul Doctors on HealthyLife.net Radio. After working with many thousands of people over the last 40 years, I've assembled sensible, evidence-based answers to the most commonly asked questions about life, death, and afterlife. And each month on this show, I interview experts on consciousness topics who share their answers. We don't claim to have all the answers or the only answers, but we do have some very good answers that have helped many people make more sense of their Earth experience. And with us today to answer those questions is Carolyn Mace, a New York Times best-selling author of 5 books, including Anatomy of the Spirit, Why People Don't Heal and How They Can, Sacred Contracts, and others. And her latest book, Archetypes, Who Are You, was published just last year. Carolyn has been everywhere on TV, radio, worldwide workshops, and has a wonderful website. Make sure you visit it, mace.com, that's M-Y-S-S.com, with many videos, some free and other very reasonably priced online seminars. So unless you've been living in a cave for the last 30 years, you're no doubt aware of her impact. So Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Our listeners and I are looking forward to hearing your answers to these most commonly asked questions, so let's get started. The first one, of course, people will wonder about is, who am I?
Well, I think that's a question that many people ask, but usually later in life, somewhere in their, let me say it's a question one asks in layers. Maybe that's a better way to put it. I think that we ask that in degrees of maturity. And somewhere in the middle years of our life, perhaps, we ask that from a deeper, profound level, where it becomes a question that redirects how we want to experience life, from wanting to see life as something we take from to wanting to see life as something we give to. So who am I becomes a more discovery of the potential we have to change the quality of the lives of others versus the quality of our own life. So that's what I would answer about that question.
So how does that, how have you experienced the people first ask that question? What's the first of the layer?
Well, there's no such thing as all people asking for the same reason, Mark. Let's just, because you're dealing with, who are the people you're talking about. There are, individuals who come to that question because their life has fallen apart. There are individuals who come to that question because they've read a lot of spiritual literature. So it depends on the route that leads you to that question. There are people who come to that question because they've been ill and they've been brought to death's door. So different routes are different motivators. There are people who come to that because they're naturally philosophically inclined and they always had their head in the stars. So, there's no such thing as a generic answer to that, and that's the first thing that needs to be understood. Secondly, I think that what is of human nature is such that we are kind of inherently designed to seek awe, to seek out the sacred, even if that's not the language a person uses for it. And that's not a language that's in the mainstream lexicon. I think the majority of people are leery of words that might ignite a deep soul transformation. So we've kind of taken out, deleted the language of the soul from the general population because these are very potent words. But nevertheless, human nature is such that it gravitates toward experiences of the sacred, though it goes through that in layers, it wants to feel important. It wants to feel significant. Human beings have a disdain for the ordinary, and that's their first motivation to seek the extraordinary. And after the extraordinary comes the sacred. And so at some point along that trajectory, a person will ask, who am I and for what reason do I have life?
Which leads us to the next question, why am I here?
Well, that's just that's an organic question people will ask because they want significance. That comes from a disdain for the ordinary. That's the beginning of that question. I want to be important. I want some reason to be alive other than a shopping cart, other than an ordinary job. It is the motivation to move down that course of life that says a job's not enough, so I'll seek a career. But eventually a career's not enough. I want a vocation. I want a calling. The majority of people I encounter exist between the frustration of having a job or a career and the longing to have a calling, but the lack of courage to go that distance, to actually bow their head, take their shoes off on sacred ground, and say, call me by name. They can't utter that prayer. They simply can't do it. So they exist in a kind of spiritual no man's land between this world, the physical world, and the inner world, because they can neither fully go into the interior world for fear that it will swallow them up, including their bank account, including their sensuality, their sexuality. It will take their whole physical world and disorient them. So they can't go there. They go there only mentally. They go there in conversation. They go there in books. But they don't really go there experientially. So they spend their life thinking, why am I here? Am I here to be, and they go there with their ego. Am I here to be important? I know I'm here to do something important. So they reduce it to career and glamour and the need to feel significant. They never get to the point of surrendering to this, that living in that high voltage realm of, you know, let my soul take over.
Or is your experience that the callings a person has are preset before this lifetime, or how those come about?
You know, we only speculate about these matters. If you think the universe releases its, you know, I mean, what you have to do is base, I don't say you have to. What I do is base my perceptions on the nature of nature, because we are creatures of nature, so we're subject to the same laws of nature. So you look at the way nature operates, and you say, well, are trees preset? Is the way the forest grows preset? No, but it has an inclination. It has a nature to it. It has a proclivity to it. And that's the same with us. When your being, your intellect, your archetypal structure has a series of patterns to it that you're going to operate within. So you are as expansive as those patterns, but they do contain you. So is your destiny written? You have endless choices within that, but let's face it, you cannot choose to be, once you're here, you can't choose to not be, I can't choose to be not, to not be someone who was born in America. I can't choose someone now. I can't be someone now who doesn't love literature. I can't be someone who doesn't love the use of words. So I am limited within the scope of what I love, but what I love has no limitations. And that's the way you have to look at it. But what I want to do with it is up to me. I can write or I cannot write, but what I can write has no limitations. How much effort I want to put into something is up to me. I can put in all the effort I want, or I can become very slothful and passive. All of those things are up to you. I can educate myself or not. I can go back for, you know, all of these things are in your hands, how creative you want to be. All of these things are up to you.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
You're the engine of your destiny.
So the next question, of course, people ask commonly is, what happens after I die?
Who knows? We can make that up. You want to make it up? We can make it up. Because that's what everybody does.
Mm-hmm.
We make it up. I mean, the one thing I am sure of is we go on. After that, we make it up.
Yeah, would you say a little more about that, please?
Well, I think that there's nobody that's actually come back with any kind. There's nothing, you know, do I think, look, we don't have our theology straight to start with. We have Earth-centric religions, when in fact we should have galactic theologies. There's life everywhere in the galaxy. So from the get-go, our theologies are kind of askew. We have gods that look like us when, in fact, gods don't look like us. So our mythologies are kind of elementary. Do we go on after this life? The likelihood is absolutely. Do I have any idea what that's like? No. Does anybody? No. I gather from near-death experiences that what is universal, no matter where research comes from near-death experiences, that we are greeted by souls who have lived, who have gone on before, who are familiar to us, and in fact maybe loved ones, and that there is a tunnel, a light tunnel. What happens after that, I have no idea. But the reports that seem to be consistent is that that realm is infinitely loving and infinitely beautiful. And that's the best anyone can say. And I do find that what is also consistent is that there is a life review, that there is a sense of being held accountable for actions, positive and negative, for actions in which we have withheld choices we could have made that were a lot more benevolent, a lot more unselfish, a lot more loving, and that those choices would have made a tremendous difference in the lives of others. And that somehow or other we are given an opportunity to see the impact those choices would have had. And that's fairly profound.
Sure.
So that's, you know, I think that there is a, just like there was, you know, in the turn of the century, the turn of last century, in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, there was a real rise in spiritualism and Ouija boards and this table thumping and trying to conjure up spirits of people who have died. And there is a lot of that today, and trying to get people who have gone on to come back and you know, have a chit-chat and that kind of thing. And I'm not sure what that's about. I don't know why people do that. They seem, because, and in part I think we've gone back to being, to absolutely convincing ourselves that we're not going to die, but they did. And we want to somehow or other make sure they're okay, but we never talk about our own deaths. Nobody in my workshop has ever once asked me, and I've taught for 30 years around the world, not once Have I been asked, do my actions, am I going to be held accountable when I die for my actions in this lifetime? While at the same time, people have no problem speaking about karma and implying that what they are experiencing in this lifetime is the result of past lifetimes, meaning that they obviously are cognizant that they once died, but they cannot cope with the possibility, if not indeed probability, and not in fact definitely, that they will die again and that they will be held accountable, i.e. an upcoming karma, when they die. That somehow or other is an absolute blank slate. So that the idea that I am accumulating actions for which I will be held accountable is an unbelievably, it's as if the active, reflective, moral conscience is not engaged. It's intriguing to me.
Excellent. Well, Jay, I think we need several more hours here. You had mentioned earlier, Carolyn, about our personified images of the divine. What is your conception of source energy, and what is this phenomena like?
To me, God is law, and that's it. God is law. If you want to understand the nature of God or the divine, it is law. Law has no religion. It's mystical law. Law is consistent. And law is fully, the mystical laws are fully and totally evident. All that exists is subject to the nature of the mystical laws. And as they incarnate, they become the physical laws of science. But the mystical laws, all law, is all that exists is subject to law. And that's the nature of God. It is consistent. It is something you can you trust, the nature of the Tao, the nature of when you extend too much into negativity, something will collapse in you that brings about a forced reboot in order for you to survive that. And in that reboot, you will become more conscious one way or another. And that is how negativity forces an awakening. When you become, you abuse your body, you will go into health, into illness. That's just the law. You've broken the laws of health. It's not a punishment. It's simply the law. It's the way laws work. Illness is subject to law. Otherwise, we would not have medicine. Everything is law. That's why all the great teachers, what did they teach? They taught law. What is Jesus? Jesus is the great teacher of the laws of healing. He was the great cosmic teacher of that. Now, the way in which the laws become personal, intimate, the way in which you come to know the nature of God personally is through prayer. And prayer is how the laws begin to pulsate within you. And a miracle is when God bends the mystical laws just for you. Because the mystical laws are fluid. Fluid. They breathe in you. They are managed by grace. And that's the nature of the divine. It is a breathing, unified field of grace. But once the laws become solid in the field of physical matter, once gravity, you experience gravity and you drop something, all the prayers in the world are not going to stop an object if you hold it above and you let go of it. You can pray to the cows come home, but you're not going to suspend that in midair. Mm-hmm. But if you pray, do not let my thought become so grave that it affects the matter in my life. Now that you'll get divine intervention with. That's the nature of God. Mm-hmm. It's not an off-planet creature with a beard that fills your Christmas basket. Nothing could be more ridiculous.
The next question people commonly ask, of course, is why is there suffering and how can I best survive and perhaps even thrive amidst it?
Well, I mean, that's a question that begs an afternoon discussion. I hope you realize that. And we begin, I have to enter that by saying, after all these years of working with people intimately, closely, constantly, I've come to the conclusion that much, if not the majority of what people suffer is of their own making. I mean, we obviously have to say that there are things that happen in life that come out of the clear blue, but there are choices people make that, I mean, I look at, for example, the tornadoes that hit the Midwest over Oklahoma and Kansas, et cetera, and how many of those people, they ask, well, weren't you supposed to put in shelters? And they said, well, we decided not to because blah, 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 blah. And it's not that it's not painful to lose their home, but the protections that they should have taken, they decided not to take for whatever reasons. And that's kind of like what I'm saying, is that the wise choices that are available to people in their lives are often not made. And in all moments of our lives, we are constantly standing at the crossroads of wisdom or woe. How often we eat what we shouldn't. We say what we shouldn't to people. We think what we shouldn't. We make foolish choices. We overspend in the moment. And then we rationalize by saying we've had a bad day. We've had a good day. We don't manage our bills properly. We don't manage things properly. So why do we suffer? Why is there suffering? Because we choose foolish things. We do foolish things. And we do it constantly, again and again and again. And we don't work our way through. We don't navigate our way out. I mean, all the spiritual teachers tell us vengeance is foolish and it won't accomplish anything. It won't accomplish anything. But we're vengeful. We make choices that are not productive. And we've learned that, but we do it anyway. So when you say we suffer, how much of our suffering is of our own making? We might say things like, well, I have a lot of fear. And many, many people tell me I've had a lot of fear. I can't move forward because of fear. But so often people don't move forward because they want another person to make decisions for them because they're terrified of the consequence of a decision. I get that. But as I said to a person yesterday in a radio show, you're either going to be unhappy not moving, or you get the, you're unhappy in the known, but at least in the unknown, you have a chance of an adventure and happiness. She's suffering because she's in the known. And she's going to continue to suffer. But she'll stay there because she's more terrified to take a risk. So why do we suffer? Because we're terrified to trust the unknown or to trust ourselves to take an adventure. So we choose to stay in the known even when it's unpleasant.
Irregardless of the cause of the suffering, how can people best survive and thrive amidst it?
But you can't thrive in suffering. You can't. I mean, well, let me just say this differently. There are certain types of suffering you can't immediately remedy. Suffering in Afghanistan, suffering in places of starvation, where the larger field of where you're living is not something you're responsible for. You're not responsible for that. You're not responsible for the larger field in which you're living that is pressing against you. You cannot easily remedy that. You are in poverty circumstances. You are raising 2-3 kids on your own, and you have a limited income. That's suffering. And it is difficult to get up every morning. And I've encountered so many people who have health issues, and they just have to keep going because they have kids to feed. That's suffering. That is genuine suffering. And you just have to keep going, and that is not easily remedied at all. And so how do they keep going? Well, you know, I have to say that the choices people make in those, this is one of the fallouts from not being part of communities anymore, not being part of tribes, not having families. Because in that wise way, it takes a village. It does take a village to raise families and to be parts of groups of people. And how we compensate for the absence of that, we are suffering because we don't have our families and our villages anymore. For exactly that reason. And people now have to find their own way. And finding your own way is a suffering. So we have to recreate villages and communities of people. And that doesn't happen overnight. But this kind of suffering is making us realize that all these decades of our love of independence and our love of thinking we should just find our own way and just be free as people has gone too far. That in fact, we need communities. And we need to build communities, and we need to be around each other. And what used to happen around churches and synagogues and communities that built around some solid structure is something we're missing. We're missing that. And somehow or other, and it was always built around a common house of prayer or a common house of worship or some thing that united people. We're missing that, and we're suffering because of that. Why are we really suffering, Mark? What's the real missing thing? We miss a common place where our pain is not talked about in therapy, but where we are united as human beings in the common experience of being human.
And the next question that people often ask is about their departed loved ones. Will they really see them again? And can they communicate with them now?
Well, I'm just, as I say, I think that I have to base this on near-death experience. But, you know, you got two parallel realities going. One is reincarnation. And if a soul has reincarnated, I don't know what to say. I mean, what if the soul has already reincarnated? What are you going to say then? And on the other hand, if there's no such thing as time is a factor of the physical world, then lives are simultaneous. We have no way of comprehending what the afterlife or simultaneous lives are. So I think we should trust that there is a cosmic structure in place that is probably very benevolent. And we will encounter not loved ones, but let's say the souls that we travel together with again. So yes, that's what I would say.
Mm-hmm. Great. And by the way, with your ability to sense energy, can you perceive in some way the energy of those who have died physically?
I have quite frequently been in places where I have sensed the presence of restless spirits. Can I put it that way? But I don't read, and I have no interest whatsoever, and I never will, in reading, you know, the dead coming back and trying to communicate with someone. I just have no use for that.
Okay, so that's a segue into the next question. Are there really ghosts and evil spirits, and what are they?
I mean, are there ghosts? Yes. And what, shall we say, do people who have passed on stay here for whatever reason? I would say yes, and I've actually seen one, but I have felt others. And why do they stay here? I'm not sure about that. I mean, the speculations I've heard have been, you know, they've died suddenly. What I will say is that in all spiritual traditions, all of them, there is a sacrament, there is a teaching, there is a ritual that aims to help a spirit collect all of a soul, collect all its fragments before it passes over. What that suggests is that we die consciously, or we die with this sense of, I have finished what I came here to do. Which means that if we don't, there must be a consequence. Number two is that there seems, of all this, that there are most of what we do in life that is not okay. You know, if somebody's a thief, or if somebody does, you know, it has a bad temper or whatever, that seems to be like just a bad thing a human being does. But the thing that's unforgivable or really carries bad karma is murder. Is when you actually kill a human being, when you tamper with their life path, because that in turn tampers with the life paths of countless other souls who were supposed to meet that person, or whose life was supposed to be impacted by the lives that person was supposed to impact. There's a whole network of threads. And so to that extent, is the person who was murdered a ghost because they didn't finish something? So I'll leave you with that thought. What is an evil spirit? Are there evil? Well, that opens the question, is there evil? And the answer is yes. Is an evil spirit a demon? Well, yeah, I acknowledge the whole world of demons, because you can't have angels and not have demons. They're partners. So yeah, there are evil spirits. Absolutely there are.
And so a kind of a related question about what happens to the life force, the soul of those who take their own lives, who kill themselves.
I don't know. I really don't. So I'm not even going to answer that. I don't know. I can't comment on that. I really can't. I don't know what happens to them. The only thing I would say is I think this is a benevolent universe. And I think that when somebody is at the point of suicide, they're not conscious, they're not rational, they're not hurting enough, you know, they are in so much pain that they're not making a conscious, clear act. And I don't believe this is a universe that, if this is a loving, benevolent universe, and I don't believe in the eternal damn Dante's version of hell. So I'll leave it at that.
All right, great. Another common question, of course, is about a person's highest purposes, and we talked about that some earlier. So what can you say to people who want to identify their soul's missions and how they can best hear their inner self's voice?
Well, what do they think a highest purpose is? What do they think that is? If someone reduces it to a task or an occupation, instead of the quality of human being they need to become, these two things go hand in hand. You can't be someone who is dishonest and who doesn't keep your word and lacks a moral conscience, and at the same time decides you want your highest spiritual purpose. These two things X each other out. It's as simple as that. So the higher purpose idea, this myth, my whole route is you start with developing yourself as a human being, your conscience, your ethics, your integrity, your self-esteem, and your whole sense of what you are able to do as a, quote, higher purpose begins to evolve in you because you become someone with the stamina to do something for others. Higher purpose means by its very implication, what is it I can do for others that makes a difference in this world? You have to understand what that means. It's not about what you can do for yourself and how much attention you can get. It's about what am I capable of doing for the lives of others. But in order to do that, you have to really become someone inside of yourself that is harmless to others.
People ask, how can I evolve beyond my early religious teachings that don't make sense to me now? Concepts like there's an eternal fiery hell, only one way to God, we're born into sin, being gay and so many other things are simple, etc. What can you comment about that, please?
That takes work, because those are superstitions. And superstitions run thick and deep in a person's grain. They really do. And I don't think people realize how strong a hold a superstition has on them, and in fact, much more so than faith and a belief in God. Superstitions are in your DNA because you learn them. You learn fear along much sooner than you learn faith. And so it takes a lot of conscious effort you almost need a kind of conscious self-exorcism. And combined with a profound commitment to inner reflection and prayer, you got to put both together. And you got to really pay attention to what it is that has you under a spell. Someone's got to really do a serious bit of work, because you got to pay attention to yourself. There's nothing about inner growth that is not a lot of work. I mean, it's a lot of work. People don't realize how superstitious and fearful driven they are until they realize how superstitious driven they are. How, you know, they are fearful of change, fearful of this, fearful of that. They don't get it until they get it. And in order to do that, they have to, you know, and how much they negotiate their relationship with truth, how frightened they are to speak the truth, to think the truth, to hear the truth, how they negotiate truth by the hour, how they can't even answer a question truthfully, like, do you care where we go to lunch? No, I don't care. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. How these are the, you know, when you talk about higher purpose, how can you even go near your higher purpose when you can't answer a simple question honestly? I've been with couples who've been, they sleep together, they eat together, they have children together, they buy homes together, they put money in the same account together. And they have never, it's been years since they've said one honest, integrous thing to each other across a dinner table. They can't do it. They can't do it. They can't say one honest thing about how they're really feeling or what they want sexually or what's really troubling them. Truth, they won't go near it. I can't do that. I can't say that. They want their highest potential.
Good. Good point. Well, the last question is, how can all this information, in other words, when a person is on the spiritual path, reads, learns more about themselves and doing some of the things you've talked about, how can that help them deal with life's toughest challenges and make the world a better place?
How can it not? How can it not help you? I mean, you know, if you decide I need to do better. I need to be a better person. I need to see my life in a clearer direction. Pick one thing. Just pick one thing. Never start with doing everything because you'll fail. You will fail. So you have to start with one thing. And one thing inevitably is attached to everything. So just start with one thing. What if you decide the one thing I'm going to do is I'm not going to betray myself anymore? I'm not going to do that. Because if you don't betray yourself, the inevitable attachment to that is it's going to be very hard for you to betray another person. So if you say, that's it, I'm no longer going to betray myself. So if I make a promise to myself, I'm not going to eat bad food. You have to stick with that. You have to stick with that. Because you're not going to betray what you've just said to yourself. And if someone, if a good friend says to you, I want to tell you this, would you keep this to yourself? You have to do that. Because you just gave someone your word. And you can't betray yourself, which means you can't betray your friend. You can no longer lie. You just can't do it. And you have to acknowledge that you have. And if you've betrayed your friend, you have to go up to her and say, I've just broken my word to you. I've just broken my word to you. I've just lied. I gave you my word, and I just broke it. So you start with something that's really not small, but it will course correct you. You want your highest potential? Become your highest potential. It's not given to you. You become it. It's who you are. It's the potential you have to be so much more than your lowest self. Instead of being driven and controlled by your superstitions, you become driven and controlled by grace, by true power, by your capacity to give your word and keep it, and not negotiate because you're terrified, but to stand up to your fears, by being able to hold your center, by not getting angry instead of getting angry, by not attaching to spectacles. When someone does something in front of you, you're able to say, that's their issue, not mine, and hold your center so that you don't hemorrhage your power. That's your highest potential. By realizing, that's a spectacle. I'm not going to lose my soul over that. That's your highest potential. Mm-hmm. By having command over yourself instead of others, your highest potential is not how you control others, but how you control yourself. Yourself. Your highest potential is decision that my life is not about controlling others. That's what a weak person does. That's what a frightened person does. That's what someone does who's out of control. Self-control is the choice of the higher potential. Inner control. That's what you do. And that's what makes all the difference. And you add prayer to that.